Severov let the image of the bombed-out building linger on the screen to allow the moment to soak in. Another reminder of the shame, humiliation, and outrage Serbians felt at the time, and still did. The general then clicked through a series of short videos of NATO tanks, planes, missile launchers, and self-propelled howitzers in action. "Nor do I need remind any of you of the history of NATO's combined arms air-land battle doctrine." He then flipped to an animated graphic representing the same battle systems, but now all connected to one another by electronic signals transmitting to and from satellites circling over Europe. "The air-land battle doctrine has now evolved into NCW, network-centric warfare, which, of course, is merely following the lead of the Americans, who also use the term NCO, network-centric operations." Severov grinned and wagged his head. "But you know how the Americans are. They always have to put their own little spin on things, don't they?" A smattering of laughter rippled through the room. Severov continued with more slides displaying facts, figures, and quotes, all of which were presented in the voluminous notebooks sitting in front of each delegate. His job today was to summarize the presentation into easily digestible bites, not to regurgitate the reams of data in their hands. NCW-NCO relies on a vast array of sensors, everything from tiny RFID chips tracking shipping crates of MREs, all the way up to orbiting satellite platforms. The essential theory of NCW-NCO is that massive inputs of data from all of these innumerable sensors, combined with faster rates of communications at all levels, increases the decision-making abilities and combat effectiveness of all units and commands, from the lowly soldier in the field to the general directing the war. The means of accomplishing this is referred to in the NATO literature as C4ISR. Command, control, communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. In other words, the Americans and Europeans believe that they have enhanced, extended, and improved the speed and effectiveness of their combat capabilities by relying on the latest communications technologies. Severov flipped to more images as he continued. GPS, cell phones, shortwave radio, radar, computers, satellites, laser-guided munitions, ships, planes, tanks, UAVs, soldiers, sailors, airmen. Everybody linked, everybody connected, everybody seeing what everybody else sees. Building on the platform of NCW, their ultimate goal is to create a vast collective network of perfect informational awareness, command, and control. One of the civilian Serbian politicians spoke up. "But General, is such a capacity even possible? It sounds like more American fake news." Severov shrugged. "It's not only possible, it's inevitable. Perhaps you have heard of IoT, the Internet of Things? American corporations are proposing to connect every toaster, light bulb, television screen, AC unit, and food blender in their homes to an integrated network so that everything is connected and monitored. You know, Alexa, buy a box of cereal, or Siri, turn the thermostat down, that sort of thing. In the same way, the American war planners are proposing an IOBT, an Internet of Battlefield Things, where everything is both a sensor and a processor, from the rifle scope to the aircraft carrier. The Pentagon imagines that in the future there will be one giant central nervous system of combat operations, coordinating efforts between units and across services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. They have even envisioned squadrons of swarming drones, air, land, and sea, all connected to one another, engaging enemies as one AI mind, fighting as fast as quantum computers can think. Severov let that idea wash over the audience, and then he winked. "Sounds pretty scary, doesn't it?" Nervous chuckles bubbled up around the room. There's no doubt that NATO and the United States rely heavily on advanced technologies to achieve their warfighting aims, and they have had some spectacular successes. Sevrov pulled up another video. We've all seen the videos of laser-guided drone munitions destroying nests of Islamic fighters. The West believes that technology is the key to everything, including warfare. Sevrov paused for effect. But I will remind everyone in this room that every war the Americans have lost, Korea, Vietnam, Somalia, and yes, Afghanistan, has been lost to technologically inferior opponents. Sevrov watched heads around the room nodding in surprised agreement as that revelation hit home. He flashed two more images, a B-2 stealth bomber in the sky, and another of a smiling, toothless, and bearded Taliban fighter holding his battered AK-47. 17 years after invading Afghanistan with their billion-dollar bombers and lasers and drones, who is still in charge of the Afghan countryside? The illiterate peasant with his $200 rifle. More heads nodded in agreement. Sevrov continued. I'm not saying that NATO and America aren't powerful military forces. They certainly are. For a moment, the humiliating image of NATO forces smashing the Russian invasion of Lithuania flashed in his brain. He pushed it aside. But even they will tell you they are powerful only because of their technological advantages, and they are only becoming more reliant on their technology. But what would happen to their vaunted military power if suddenly their radars and radios, satellites and lasers, strike fighters and helicopters, cruise missiles and missile cruisers, GPS and drones were suddenly snatched out of their hands with a flip of a switch? The general pulled up a new slide titled Russian Strategic Doctrine, Radio Electronic Combat. We have taken an entirely different approach from NATO. Whereas NATO sees the electromagnetic spectrum as a means of improving combat capabilities in the battle space, we view the electromagnetic spectrum as the battle space, and perhaps the most important one. Sevrov then tapped a few keys on his computer keyboard, pulling up a live video feed of a handheld camera focused on a four-axled cab-over truck with stabilizer bars extended perpendicular from the open bed. EW troops scrambled over and around the green all-terrain vehicle, monitoring the vertical extension of a huge telescoping mast reaching straight up for the sky. The handheld camera swung over to three more identical trucks in a semicircle several hundred feet away. Their masts were already extended to more than 100 feet. What you are witnessing here is the deployment of our Murmansk BN electronic warfare system just north of your airbase. Murmansk BN is just one of several new systems we've brought into service in the last year. It has an operational range of 3,000 kilometers and is capable of locating enemy radio signals such as the American High Frequency Global Communications, HFGC system, and targeting the source. It is also capable of monitoring radio signals and even jamming them over that incredible distance. Sevrov tapped another key and pulled up a picture of an American Civil War Confederate cavalry unit on the attack. Some claim it was the Southern Americans who first engaged in EW by deploying telegraphers with their advanced cavalry units, who would spoof federal troops with false orders, sending them to the wrong locations or reporting enemy positions that didn't exist. Sevrov smiled broadly. Of course, our own troops have done much the same thing in recent operations, sending phony text messages and voicemails, confusing and frightening enemy combatants in our latest version of PSYOPs. Suddenly, cell phones vibrated and buzzed all across the room, as delegates checked their emergency text messages. A wave of laughter bubbled up. A few concerned faces frowned as well. Sevrov's team had crashed through the security architecture of their phones and sent them all a spoof text, cracking an obscene joke at President Ryan's expense. A few chuckles of admiration murmured among the Serbian officers. An oil painting depicting a battleship engagement during the 1904-1905 Russo-Japanese War appeared on the screen. Sevrov continued, "But without question, the first instance of radio jamming during war happened in 1904, when a Russian operator jammed Japanese radio signals during a bombardment of Port Arthur. Of course, radio jamming was practiced in World War I and perfected in the Great Patriotic War by all sides." Sevrov tapped more keys. Another live feed came up showing a BAZ-6900 series cab-over truck, another four-axled transport, but this one was enclosed. A three-dish array deployed on the back end of the roof rotated in a slow circle. "This is the Krasuka 4 jamming station with a 300-kilometer range, designed to neutralize airborne radar systems like the E-3 Sentry AWACS and the E-8 Joint STARS. It is also capable of attacking low Earth orbit, LEO systems like the LaCrosse Onyx radar imaging reconnaissance satellites, and, of course, UAVs like the Reaper. And these are just a few of the many new systems we're deploying now, including handheld devices and aerial drone systems." Sevrov surveyed the room again. He had their attention for sure now, particularly the Republika Srpska delegates. "Without question, we are years, even decades ahead of NATO in EW weaponry, deploying systems that will utterly deny NATO's C4ISR capabilities with a virtual flip of the switch. Flipping that switch will render them electronically blind, deaf, and dumb, completely disrupting their battle plans. And one last thing, perhaps equally important. All of these systems, and others detailed in your briefing books, also provide impenetrable defenses for our own forces against NATO's inferior EW capabilities. In short, our doctrine provides total electronic support, protection, and attack resources for all of our tactical and strategic operations. As you can clearly see, our radio-electronic combat doctrine is both a sword and a shield, and my government is proud to extend both to our Slavic brethren throughout the region." Sevrov shut his laptop and cast a glance back up at the portraits of old Serbian generals hanging on the wall. He swore they were smiling at him. General Sevrov set his controller down, then stepped out from behind the lectern, raising his opened palms and smiling like a kindly uncle. "Questions?" Chapter 18. Central Bosnia. The driver squinted his weary eyes through the fog of cigarette smoke in the truck cab. The dark figure in his headlights stood in the two-lane asphalt road far ahead, waving a red flashlight. The driver tapped the brights. The figure in the road was clad in black and masked, with a rifle slung behind his back. The driver's heart fluttered for a moment. The Croatian mafia was active in this part of the country, and truck hijackings weren't uncommon. He wasn't sure if he should try and speed past the guy, or maybe run him over. But before he could decide, his headlights caught the white fluorescent Polizia patch blazoned across the man's chest, and the driver's tension eased a little. He geared down and tapped the big truck's brakes with a short bark of compressed air. The truck slowed to a crawl as the policeman leaped onto the running board, seizing the chrome handle assist on the side of the cab. He directed the driver onto a rutted dirt road that angled off into a deserted farm a few hundred meters from the highway. The truck driver panicked again, but the tactical officer could easily shoot through the glass if he tried anything. So what was he to do? When the truck reached the farmhouse, the cop signaled for the driver to stop and cut the lights, which he did, killing the engine and setting the parking brake with a final blast of air. The driver's door flew open, and the policeman grabbed a fistful of the trucker's stained soccer jersey, flinging him all the way down into the hard dirt with a crashing thud. Before the driver could raise himself up, a knee in his spine forced him back down, and a strong pair of hands wrenched one of his arms back. The driver felt something hard and sharp cut into his wrist with a zipping sound, and then his other arm was yanked into the same position, and the other plastic cuff was zipped into place. A hand shoved the driver's face into the ground and held it there for a moment, a silent command to lie still and be quiet. What else could he do? The officer finally stood, relieving the pressure from the driver's back. He heard the man unsling his weapon and rack the firing bolt. Warm urine flooded the driver's oily trousers. He was going to die. The tall policeman raised a pair of bolt cutters and snipped the padlocks with a couple violent cuts. The shorter officer pulled the ruined padlocks off, and the two of them lifted the handles and unbolted the trailer doors. They pulled out their flashlights and scanned the contents. It was a stack of cardboard boxes, 8 high, marked electronics and made in China. The tall policeman climbed into the trailer and with a crash pulled down a box as the shorter one glanced over at their partner standing guard over the truck driver and watching the road. The tall policeman pulled out his heavy combat knife and slashed open the top seal, revealing several smaller boxes of LED desk lamps with flexible necks. The two exchanged a worried glance through their balaclavas. The tall one pulled down another box, then stood on his toes and flashed his light toward the back of the truck. He turned around, his eyes beaming. He flashed a thumbs up, then pulled down 3 more boxes to make room to crawl. He lowered his long arm and the smaller cop grabbed his hand and pulled, and soon the two of them were scrambling over a few rows of boxes to get to the real thing. Behind the stacks of desk lamps were a dozen wooden crates about 10 feet long. The shorter cop pulled off the balaclava, spilling out a wave of shoulder-length blonde hair. The woman grinned ear to ear and flashed her light on one of the crates as the tall cop pulled his balaclava off as well and started working the crate lid with his thick blade. The weak nails squeaked inside the soft pine as the knife levered up the lid. When his fingers could finally get purchase, the big man sheathed his knife and pulled the lid off with his hands and tossed it aside as the woman knelt down and yanked out the packing material. They were looking for 122-millimeter missiles. Instead, they found a crate of cold, rolled steel plumbing pipe. The woman, a GRU major, swore a vile curse in her mother tongue. Russian. Near Tientiste, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. 80 kilometers south, a 39-foot-long Happy Times tour bus was parked behind a line of trees, far from the empty highway. 8 men in pairs, including the Greeks, Captain Walib and Lieutenant Jabrailov, pulled heavy 10-foot-long wooden crates out from the wide luggage compartments beneath the bus's passenger cabin, and loaded them onto a flatbed truck for the drive to the camouflaged storage building 100 meters away. Chapter 19. Washington, D.C. It was an informal meeting, if any meeting in the Situation Room could ever be characterized as such, particularly with the president and his closest advisors on hand. Sec-State Scott Adler, Sec-Def Robert Burgess, DNI Mary Pat Foley, and Chief of Staff Arnie Van Dam. A regional map of the Balkans was displayed on one of the big screens on the wall nearest the table, along with satellite photographs of Russian forces in and around Belgrade, Serbia. President Ryan had ordered up a buffet of salads and sandwich fixings for the late dinner gathering. He had a few things on his mind that he wanted to get cleared up as soon as possible, and this was the only time Arnie could pull everyone together. With 100 urgent national and global issues clawing at his schedule every day, Ryan had learned to prioritize better than most. But he'd also learned that the White House wasn't just a fire station, and his job wasn't limited to turning the hose on the nearest blaze raging out of control. Anticipation was one of his great strengths, born out of decades of analytical experience. Better to keep the fire from starting than to try to put it out. He had also learned to trust his gut, technically his limbic system, and his gut was boiling. Ryan stacked a few slices of rare roast beef between pieces of dark and hearty pumpernickel bread, slathered with Dijon mustard, serving himself after the others had filled their plates. Only D&I Foley helped herself to the kale salad with cranberries, almonds, and fig dressing, which she ate seated in a chair next to Arnie. Sec-State Adler and Sec-Def Burgess sat across from them, each sipping hot black coffee from a heavy ceramic mug bearing the presidential seal. "Thank you all for taking the time out of your schedules and away from your families," Ryan said, taking the black leather chair at the head of the room. "I'm hoping this will be a short one." Ryan took a big bite of his sandwich. "You mentioned two questions in your memo," Arnie said. Ryan nodded, swallowing. "The first question I want to tackle is this Russian buildup in Serbia. My PDB this morning, presidential daily brief, contained photos of Murmansk BNEW vehicles deployed near Belgrade." Ryan hit one of the pictures on the big screen monitor with his laser pointer. "I'm told it's part of their Slavic sword and shield military exercise. Are we convinced that's all there is to this?" As the Director of National Intelligence, Mary Pat Foley oversaw the intelligence gathering and processing of all 16 agencies in the IC, including the CIA. She didn't miss much, and even scanned Ryan's daily PDBs. "The sword and shield exercise is an annual event now, 3 years in a row. This one is the largest one yet, and the most sophisticated. But we have no indication of hostile intent." The SecDef set his coffee down. "It's a massive training exercise for Russian, Serbian, and Belarusian Spetsnaz units. It's the wrong mix of forces to launch any kind of sustained cross-border strike, if that's your concern, Mr. President." "Keyword, sustained," Ryan said. "Noted," the SecDef agreed. "Spetsnaz are their best troops, and the EW equipment they've deployed is top drawer. Some say better than ours," Ryan said. "Interesting combo. Putting their most advanced equipment that far forward is a hell of a security risk for them." "They must really want to make an impression." "They do," Sec-State Adler said. "They're feeling the pressure in that part of the world. Montenegro just joined NATO last year. Croatia and Slovenia are already members. Macedonia wants to join, and so does Bosnia-Herzegovina, except for the Republika Srpska. They all want to join the EU, even some Serbian politicians. The Russians are feeling encircled, and Serbia is the key to stopping the advance." Ryan rubbed his chin. "Okay. Let's assume all of this is to keep the Serbians in the fold, and that it actually works. That doesn't stop the rest of the cards from falling out of their hands. Their strategic situation will continue to deteriorate. So what's the play here?" "Restore their reputation," the SecDef offered. "They let NATO bomb the hell out of the Serbs during the war. Maybe this is their way to try and rehabilitate themselves with their Slavic brethren." "National and ethnic appeals are very strong these days. Catalonia, Belgium, Brexit. The European Union is threatened by nationalism. It only makes sense for the Russians to play on that to their advantage," Mary Pat said. "While Europe is dividing, Russia might be trying to gather her Slavic children under her wing." "I'm sure that's part of all of this," Ryan said. "But there's something more." He stood and stared at the images on the wall monitors. "You all know how these guys think. If they can't take a country outright, they like to stir up the pot." "Which pot are you talking about?" Van Damme asked. Ryan pointed at the center of the regional map. "Seems to me that there used to be 60,000 NATO peacekeepers over there to enforce the peace accords. But they're all pulled out now, aren't they?" Adler shifted in his seat. "Down to about 600 total for the whole area." Ryan turned to him. "The Europeans were the ones who made a hash of that whole thing, and they're the ones who promised to keep an eye on it. What happened?" The Secretary of State shrugged. "Europe's always been that way. They never carry their full load, and they seldom follow through. As far as Bosnia is concerned, they didn't want to pay the price for continued peacekeeping operations, and their attention is drawn elsewhere these days. I thought the Europeans had a high representative over the entire Bosnian government, some joker who can pull crazy politicians and stubborn bureaucrats out of office and implement laws or whatever else they need to do to keep the peace and make the government function, Arnie said. You sound a little jealous of this high representative guy, Ryan said, smiling. It would make things a lot easier around here if you had that kind of power over Congress. Arnie's pale blue eyes smiled mischievously. No thanks, Ryan said. The Secretary of State said, the bottom line is that in recent years, the High Representative has stepped back from any kind of intervention in order to promote Bosnian self-determination. Which is just another way for the Europeans to say they don't want to be bothered with it anymore. But by pulling out those peacekeepers, they've created one hell of a power vacuum, Ryan said. And the Russians, like nature, abhor a vacuum. The president crossed over to the wall of monitors. There are recent reports of escalating violence in Bosnia and the reformation of ethnic militias, Foley said. That fits your vacuum thesis quite neatly. It's a damn powder keg over there, Adler said. 500 years of blood feuds and genocides. It's like the damn Hatfields and McCoys, but with IEDs and machine guns. Ryan touched the Bosnian map. The Russian new-gen warfare model fits this situation perfectly, doesn't it? They have the means, the proximity, and the natural target. An ethnically and politically divided country right next door to Serbia. Even if the Russians don't want to take Bosnia over, another bloody civil war in the heart of Europe will demand a NATO response. Tying up NATO forces for years, maybe decades, Burgess said, freeing the Russians up to pursue their interests elsewhere. And keeping NATO from any further expansion, Adler added. The DNI shook her head grimly. That's playing with fire. After the last war, the Bosniaks aren't going to wait around for NATO to save them from Serbian attacks. They'll retaliate quickly and in force. There are 25 million Muslims in Europe who might rise up if NATO doesn't act swiftly enough, or if the Serb attacks are too vicious, the sex state added. Bosnia, Ryan said, processing a thought. He tapped the map again. The cradle of modern jihad against the West. This is where it all began, 26 years ago. Ryan turned around to face the long mahogany table, his prodigious memory kicking into high gear. Osama bin Laden was issued a Bosnian passport at one time, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, was granted Bosnian citizenship. Thousands of jihadis flocked from all over the world to fight in the war against the Western powers in defense of the Ummah in Bosnia. Al-Qaeda learned its first battle lessons here before moving on to Afghanistan. We can't let that happen again, the SecDef said. The radicals don't need another base of operations, particularly one in the heart of Europe. We need to stomp that out before it even gets started. So that's the Russian plan? Reignite a Muslim war in Europe, Arnie said. Burgess and Adler exchanged a worried glance as Ryan poured himself a cup of coffee. Maybe, Ryan said. Maybe, Adler asked. The Russians aren't stupid, Ryan said, and they're pretty good at history, too. He took a sip of hot coffee as he headed back for the map. That's a lot of chaos, and it could easily spin out of control, especially if the Serbs are suddenly on the bad end of the stick again. For the sake of their existing alliances and their credibility, the Russians would have to intervene. If ethnic Croats in Bosnia got caught up in all of that, Croatia might take advantage of the situation again, just like in the last war, Adler said. They booted 200,000 Serbs out of Croatia in 1995. Some of their politicians have dreams of greater Croatia, just like many Serbs dream of greater Serbia. Ryan touched the map again. Here, Sarajevo. Ring a bell, anyone? Oh my God, Foley said. World War I. Archduke Ferdinand and his wife killed by a Serbian nationalist, right in the heart of the city, Ryan said. That was the spark that lit the fuse, resulting in the collapse of three empires, including Russia's, Adler said. The Russians are a lot of things, but suicidal isn't one of them, Ryan said. A civil war in Bosnia could turn into another clash of empires, another world war. So you don't think the Russians are engaging in new-gen warfare over there? Van Damme said. The president sat back down, rubbing his face with frustration. Hell, Arnie, I don't know. That's why I have all of you here. My gut tells me no. But I know we're missing something. I can feel it. What did Twain say? History doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. He glanced around the room. We need to keep a close eye on this situation. I'd like each of you to take another swipe at this stuff with your staffs and get back to me with your best ideas by the end of the week. I'm not in the mood for any surprises, Russian or otherwise. Understood? Heads nodded around the table as notes were taken on paper and tablets. The president glanced back up at the map of Bosnia and its capital city. He knew his son was due to land in Sarajevo in the next several hours. He had to remind himself that Junior managed to survive a killer typhoon in Singapore last year. But the fiery storm his son might be heading into now would be far more dangerous. The president's thoughts about his son were interrupted by his chief of staff. You said you had another question about the Russians. Yeah, but it's not exactly connected. My PDB this morning contained secondary confirmation of the report we received a couple of weeks ago about the Syrian army strike on Idlib with thermobaric munitions. Deploying the new Starfire heavy flamethrower system, the SecDef said, 122mm thermobaric missiles fixed on the new T-14 Armata chassis. Thermobarics? That's some nasty stuff, the DNI said. Almost as destructive as a tactical nuclear strike, but without the radiation. I thought the Syrian government had a ceasefire with al-Nusra, Arnie said, trying to stabilize the area. There was a ceasefire, Foley said. Al-Nusra leadership got complacent, and the Syrians took advantage. Decapitated the entire senior council in one strike, including the emir. Just like those bastards to break a truce, the sec state said. He was a long-time opponent of the vicious Damascus regime. But damn smart, the SecDef said. He turned to the president. How does a Syrian army operation tie into the Russians? A Syrian operation, sure. But with Russian weapons, Russian training, and, I'd be willing to bet, Russian advisors on the ground. Without the Russians, Damascus would have fallen by now. They're the reason a ceasefire with the opposition was even possible to begin with. But you're connecting what happened in Syria with what's happening in Serbia, Foley said, her face frowning with curiosity. You think it's two sides of the same coin? If the Syria situation starts to spin out of control, our attention will be focused there, and not on the Balkans, Ryan offered, tossing out a breadcrumb. Foley picked it up. And if the Balkans heat up, we won't be paying attention to Syria. SecDef Burgess added, and it's not as if there aren't a hell of a lot of other things going on in the world right now. I see it now, Adler said. The Russians are playing a little three-dimensional chess with us. Ryan sighed, exasperated. I can't shake the feeling there's another pair of hands at work here. Whose? Foley asked. Cui bono. Who benefits? Ryan asked, falling back on his Jesuit training. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Russians, even the Chinese and the Norkays, if all of our attention is diverted away from the Pacific, Burgess said. All true. But something tells me there's a missing piece. Something obvious and right in front of our noses, if we could just see it. Ryan stood, buttoning his suit coat, signaling an end to the session. The others stood as well. He thanked them again for coming on such short notice as Arnie ushered them out the door. Anything I can do for you, boss? Arnie asked. Maybe a couple aspirin. And a crystal ball, if you can find one. Arnie smiled. Back in the jiff with the aspirin. And that crystal ball is still on back order. He shut the door behind him. Ryan reached for the phone to call his son, but caught himself. It was 6 hours later over there, and the kid was probably asleep. Besides, Junior could take care of himself. Chapter 20. Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The man was pouring himself a cup of hot tea when a pair of heavy boots clomped onto his front porch. Before he could set the pot down, his door rattled beneath the pounding of a thick hand. The man assumed the worst. He pulled a 9mm pistol out of a drawer and marched toward the door, holding the weapon behind his back. Just as he arrived, the hand pounded on the door again. He unlocked it and flung it open. "Tarik," the man said. "It's an honor, idiot! What are you thinking?" Tarik Brkić shouldered his way into the man's house, followed by two younger Bosniaks, dark and determined. They slammed the door shut as Brkić stormed toward the wide picture window, where a huge black akab, Al-Qaeda in the Balkans, flag hung. The banner bore the infamous white Arabic letters declaring the Shahada. The tall, burly Chechen snatched the black akab flag and balled it up before shoving it into the man's quivering hands. "I don't understand." Brkić had a full, wild red beard streaked with gray, and a voice cold and hollow like an empty grave. But it was the Chechen's milky white eye that struck terror deep into the man's soul, a brutal reminder of Brkić's terrifying war record. "The whole point of hiding in the middle of the infidels is to remain invisible. And you go and hang that flag?" "But I'm far from the road, and I'm proud to be in the jihad. The Kafir Serbs never come out this way." "Take your damnable pride back up north and gather with the others who are under constant OSA-OBA surveillance," Brkić said, stepping closer. "But if you do anything to jeopardize our work here again, I will personally make you a martyr for the cause." The man bowed his head. "I understand. I am truly sorry." Brkić laid a calloused hand on the man's shoulder. "Zeal is good, but wisdom is better if we are going to win the day." The man nodded violently, cursing his own stupidity. The Chechen felt his burner phone vibrating in his pocket. There was only one person who had his number, and never a reason for him not to pick up when he called. Brkić signaled to his men with a nod, and the three of them headed back outside. When they shut the door behind him, he answered. "Yes." "You did well," the electronically altered voice said, "but there is still much to do." Anyone listening in on the encrypted line, an impossibility, his technicians assured him, would not be able to tell the gender, age, or nationality of either of them. But Brkić knew the caller well from years before, under the code name Red Wing, from a time when Brkić had another name too.
"I'm following the plan, according to schedule."
"Perfectly, as far as I'm concerned. But my sense is that we need to move the calendar forward. Keep striking while the iron is hot. It's time for sharper measures." The Chechen bristled. They had agreed to a plan and to a timetable more than 2 years ago. Thanks to their cooperation, Brkić had been able to smuggle in jihadi fighters from Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Morocco, and elsewhere, along with weapons and much-needed cash and drugs to finance their operations. What Red Wing didn't understand was that Brkić had yet another plan, and another timetable, with an even larger agenda. But Red Wing could never know that. Red Wing wouldn't understand. Worse, Red Wing would oppose it. Red Wing was a reliable ally, but not a true believer. Brkić still needed Red Wing's contacts and resources, but it was Allah himself who guided Brkić's steps now.
"What do you propose?" Brkić finally asked.
Red Wing laid out a new timetable. It was possible to carry it out, Brkić calculated, and smart. But it was also dangerous.
If it failed or endangered his own larger plan, he would kill Red Wing and fulfill the will of Allah instead. But for now, Red Wing was useful, and their smaller plan helpful for the cause.
"I will plan the next mission immediately," Barkich said. "You are a great patriot and a servant of the Most High."
Barkich found that in life, it often wasn't possible to be both.
"His will be done."
Chapter 21. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Jack powered up his cell phone as the airport bus shuttled from the plane toward the small, dated terminal, an unpretentious glass and concrete building surrounded by low hills dotted with houses and pine-covered mountains beyond. No point in wasting time, he thought. He scrolled through the list of names Gavin had sent him, a list of 11 blonde, blue-eyed women in their 20s, birth-named Aida Kuric, all living in Sarajevo. Gavin even included photos from driver's licenses or other official documents, along with their contact information, but with the caveat that the Bosnian databases he found weren't always up to date and might not be completely reliable. At least it was a good start, and with any luck, one of these women would be the adult version of the young girl in his mother's cherished memory. He actually looked forward to delivering his mother's letter to this woman, though she had forbidden him to read it in advance. She didn't say, however, that he couldn't hang around to see the woman's response. Jack knew his mother, and whatever she wrote would bless this Aida Kuric person down to her toenails. He owed his mother a lot. Well, everything, actually, and she never asked anything of him. So in a way, this was a blessing to him as well. The smile he'd see on her face when she got the good news, and the nice job son he'd get would be worth whatever minor hassles he was going to face over the next few days. He just hoped this Aida person appreciated the gift his mother had given her and would somehow reciprocate, even if it was just a letter in response. Jack fetched his one piece of slightly oversized luggage from baggage claim and passed easily through a largely disinterested passport check, then snagged a wad of local currency at an ATM in the lobby. Bosnian convertible marks, a.k.a. BAM. Jack turned around and saw a 20-something guy in a worn polo shirt and jeans, holding a handwritten sign that read Jack Ryan and scanning the lobby. They locked eyes, and the driver smiled broadly.
"Mr. Ryan?"
"Jack, please." Jack stuck out his hand and the man shook it enthusiastically. "You are?"
"Adnan."
"Great to meet you, Adnan. Ready to roll?"
"Let me get your bag," Adnan said, reaching for the handle, but Jack waved him off.
"I got it, no sweat." He knew the man was angling for a tip, but Jack was always a good tipper, and like his dad, he didn't care for people making a fuss over him, whatever the reason.
"Okay,"
the driver said, nodding and pointing at the sliding glass door exit. The two of them headed out into the surprising heat of a bright September afternoon. Jack read online that it was always better to arrange for a cab or car service in advance. The locals often jacked up the price if you just showed up. This way, the price was set and not negotiable, and the driver knew where to go in advance, which in this case was an address for an Airbnb that Jack had found near the Starigrad, the old town. After a change of clothes into something cooler, he'd start his search for Aida Kuric, and maybe try to find a place that sold this chivapi stuff he'd heard so much about. Adnan popped the trunk on a slightly worse-for-wear silver Toyota sedan, and Jack tossed his roller into it. Adnan's front passenger seat was crowded with boxes of used business books in German and Serbo-Croatian, along with a few English-language thrillers, so Jack climbed into the back seat. Adnan threaded his way through Sarajevo's busy streets, crowded with mostly late-model cars, crammed public buses, and at least one Tito-era trolley car straight off the set of Dr. Zhivago. Like most urban centers these days, Sarajevo had a lot of trash on the ground and graffiti sprayed on the walls, Jack saw. Had it not been for the street signs, Jack might have thought he was in a working-class suburb of Rome or Paris.
"American, yes?"
Adnan asked in a thick accent. He glanced at Jack in his rearview mirror.
"That obvious?"
Your email address, tell me this.
A battered Mercedes sedan stopped short in front of them as he spoke, his eyes on Jack in the rear view. But somehow Adnan sensed the trouble. He blasted his horn and swerved into another lane to avoid a collision.
First time in Bosnia, Jack?
Yeah.
What do you think?
So far, so good.
Jack was grateful for the air conditioner, even though it clearly needed a shot of Freon. Adnan smiled broadly.
It's a beautiful country, with beautiful women and the best food.
Yes, very beautiful.
Can't wait to find out, Jack said, suddenly realizing his faux pas.
The food, I mean. I hear the thing to get is cevapi.
Yes, it's the best. We are famous for it. And cheap. The food here is very good prices for you Americans.
Adnan's phone rang and he picked up, chattering in Bosanski with the caller on the other end. Jack cast his gaze back outside. The people in their cars or walking the pavement seemed neither particularly well-dressed nor desperately poor, and many of them were smoking, young and old alike. Like city dwellers everywhere, they had mostly unsmiling faces, stress-hardened against the harsh realities of not enough wages and too high rents. The anxious energy of the city radiated against the car's tinted glass like the rays of the sun.
Adnan hung up. Sorry about that.
No worries. Everything okay?
My mother. She's sick.
I'm sorry.
Not bad. Just a cold. But I worry, you know?
It's your mother. You should worry, Jack said. Adnan smiled at that.
How long are you in Bosnia?
Jack didn't particularly care to answer questions, especially from strangers, but this guy was a driver and just trying to make small talk. Right?
A week, Jack lied.
He had no idea how long he'd be in town. He might even be leaving tomorrow if his luck held.
Too bad. There is much to see, especially out in the country. Business?
Pleasure.
Good. You Americans work too hard.
What about you? Is this your full-time job?
Me, yes. One of them. I also study German, and sometimes work at my father's shop, and sometimes clean windows. Whatever work I can get.
Jobs are hard to get here?
More than 40% unemployment here in the city. Very bad.
Why so high?
People moving into the city from the country every day. But mostly, it is stupid government and corrupt politicians causing problems. Hard to develop industries and jobs when you pay too much in taxes and bribes to idiots like we got.
Trust me, you don't have a monopoly on idiots, Jack said. Your English is very good. You learned it in school?
Mostly on the internet, playing video games. School not so good here.
I saw your books in the front seat. You're studying German and business. Thinking about starting an importing company?
No, export company. Starting with me.
I'm sorry?
I want to learn enough German to emigrate. 80,000 Bosnians leave every year looking for work, especially in Germany. I have a cousin in Frankfurt, drives a taxi. Soon as I save up enough money, I'm going there.
That's gotta be tough. Leaving your own country to find work somewhere else, Jack offered.
What choice do I have? You go where the work is. If I make enough, maybe come back.
Jack didn't know what else to say. Adnan was like millions of other people displaced by the crushing economic realities of globalism. Jack was lucky he was born in a country that still knew how to compete.
How much longer until we arrive?
10 minutes, maybe.
Adnan kept weaving in and out of lanes and even ran a few yellow lights. Not being on the meter put a fire under his tail, which didn't bother Jack at all. He glanced back out the window and enjoyed the ride, absorbing as much detail as he could. There were plenty of small private shops and kiosks selling tobacco and convenience items, but also chain shopping markets, department stores, and big banks, particularly foreign ones, as the taxi neared the city center. There were several mosques, their soaring minarets stabbing the skyline. He wasn't used to being in a Muslim-majority city, But he also saw a fair number of churches, Catholic and Orthodox, and he'd read somewhere that the city still had a vibrant Jewish community. No wonder Sarajevo was referred to as the Jerusalem of Europe. But there weren't any soaring skyscrapers or super-wide boulevards in the oldest part of the historic city, nor any cranes or signs of new construction. Sarajevo felt like an old suit, well-tailored and serviceable, but worn and tired. No new construction meant nobody was planning for a bright and expansive future. Maybe the lack of it was partly a function of the city's historical sensibilities, but more likely it meant this was a city without visionary leadership, and perhaps without hope. Jack noticed as they crossed a bridge that the Miljanska River was barely a trickle in the wide, littered bed that marked the southern boundary of the old town. Adnan turned and made his way to a narrow but unremarkable street, flanked by low concrete buildings just tall enough to block the sun. Checking his Google Maps, he parked in front of a driveway leading to an alley, bordering a four-story apartment complex. "Here we are," Adnan said. 20 marks, please." Jack opened his wallet and pulled out his Visa card. Adnan frowned. "Cash is better." "Your website said you took Visa and MasterCard." "Sure, but cash is better." Adnan saw the skeptical look in Jack's eyes. "If you do not have the cash, I will take the card. But in my country, there's a 17% tax on credit cards and a 3% fee, so I lose 20% if I take the card."
20%? No wonder these guys were struggling.
"No problem," Jack said, and pulled out a 20-mark bill and tossed him another 10 for the tip, which, according to the travel guides, wasn't necessary to do in this part of the world. But 10 marks was about $6, and Jack figured Adnan was working his ass off just to keep his nose above water.
"Thank you."
Adnan reached for his door handle.
"Let me get your bag.
Just pop the trunk, will you?"
"Yeah, sure."
Adnan shoved a business card into Jack's hand.
"You need a ride. You call Adnan, okay?"
Jack pocketed the card and grinned. "Who else would I call?"
"Oh, one more thing I should tell you. There is no water in Sarajevo from midnight to 5 in the morning.
"Is there a water shortage?" Adnan shook his head, grinning.
"No, no water shortage."
"Then why?" Adnan shrugged.
"Who knows? But plan accordingly."
Jack pulled his bag out of the trunk, slammed the lid, and waved goodbye as Adnan pulled away. He turned into the alley and headed for his building. He hadn't noticed the Audi sedan parked at the end of the street, let alone the man in the loose tie and rumpled suit intently marking Jack's arrival. And even if he had, he wouldn't have known the man's name was Dragan Kolak. Chapter 22. Near Tientista, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Tadic Berkic's 4x4 Nissan quad pickup arrived at the camp at the end of the dusty road, his driver heading for the camouflaged storage facility. A bearded Tunisian raised a palm in half-salute and smiled as the Chechen commander passed. Berkic was pleased, despite the earlier call from Red Wing. The Tunisian was one of a group of 18 jihadi fighters trained and equipped here in the last 2 months and heading out for Germany later tonight, soon to be replaced with fresh new recruits from Kosovo and Macedonia. The foundation was being laid for an independent Muslim state in the heart of Europe, guided only by Sharia law, and beholden to no one but Allah himself. But independence was not enough. Even Red Wing understood that. Such a state would pose too great a threat to the European powers, a humiliating reminder of the Islamic flood that nearly swamped Europe centuries before. NATO would crush it at the first opportunity. How to protect such a state? That was where he and Red Wing differed. As for the rest of Europe, hadn't Islamic armies once invaded Spain and Portugal, France and Austria, Italy and Hungary, Bulgaria and Greece, Crete and Malta? Hadn't Muslim fighters stormed the city gates of Constantinople, Athens, Moscow, Vienna, Lisbon and Madrid? Brkić believed with all of his heart that former Muslim lands would be Muslim again, and Sharia would come to all of Europe, either through demographics or, sooner, by force of arms, which he preferred. As a prolific father and a ruthless fighter, he was proud that he had excelled at both. The Nissan pulled up to the storage building and parked next to a Happy Times tour van, just as Emir stepped into view. Brkić grinned broadly and signaled for the driver to stop. He leaped out of the vehicle and embraced the smaller Bosniak in a bear hug. They were related by marriage and by blood, or at least the shedding of it.
Emir, you bring good news.
Emir smiled almost shyly.
Good news, yes, but even more than that. Come.
Emir steered the larger man through the opened, sliding doors of the warehouse. It was too far from the nearest paved road to be seen, even with binoculars. It was further hidden by the small draw where it was built, and flanked on three sides by towering pines. As a precaution, the steel roof was insulated inside and out with natural materials to eliminate any kind of heat signature or optical detection from overhead surveillance. Outwardly, the building appeared to be an oversized barn. It was large enough to hold several wheeled vehicles, service bays, welding equipment, an industrial forklift, tools, and most important, a Bosnian Army BM-21 Grad multiple rocket launcher. Stolen during the confusion of the last war, it had been stored and maintained in secret by Brkić ever since. The Grad and its variants were the most ubiquitous multiple rocket launch systems, MRLS, in the world, in service in more than 70 countries, from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe. Of Soviet design, the Grad had been around since the 1960s, and its ease of use, simple maintenance requirements, and enormous destructive potential made it one of the most effective artillery systems ever designed. The gasoline-powered 8-cylinder 6x6 truck mounted a box launcher of 40 122mm rocket tubes, and was operated by a 3-man crew. The rockets could be launched from inside the cab or externally by a trigger on the end of a 64-meter cable. The BM-21's primary flaw was its accuracy. The fin-stabilized dumb rockets were targeted with Cold War-era optical periscopes and collimators. Originally designed as an area denial weapon to blunt massed armor and infantry assaults, the Grad system relied on large numbers of relatively inaccurate rockets and their high explosive payloads to overwhelm opponents. Over the years, the unguided rockets increased in range and accuracy with improved engines and more reliable propellants, but the Grad was never considered a precision weapon. Until now. The TOS-2 Starfire 122mm missile featured a new and highly efficient solid-fuel propellant, which meant a larger payload without sacrificing range. Most important, computers on board each missile provided laser and GPS guidance that adjusted the missile fins during trajectory, allowing for minimal but sufficient in-flight maneuver to ensure highly accurate targeting. All the BM-21 launcher had to do was fire the missile in approximately the right direction, and the automated, computer-controlled guidance systems would take over. Brkić's plans now hinged on the Syrian and the magic tricks he'd brought with him. Emir and Brkić made their way past sparking arc welders and the clang of steel hammers toward the middle of the facility, where the BM-21 Grad vehicle stood.
Aslan! Tariq shouted.
The big Chechen lieutenant was standing on the launch platform. He whipped around at the sound of his name.
Commander!
He called out and jumped down onto the concrete floor. The two men crashed into each other in a hard embrace, long-lost comrades in a too-long war.
It's so good to see you again, Commander, Jabrailov said.
Brkić beamed with pride.
Your bravery and your patience have reaped a great reward.
Jabrailov shrugged.
It's for our people. How can I do less?
Like most Chechens, the lieutenant despised the Russians, a long and bitter oppressor of Chechnya. After years of suffering under the Russian boot, the latest Chechen government decided to join forces with its stronger enemy, and many young Chechen fighters joined their ranks. Many Chechens refused to serve with the hated Russian army.